Hi there, I'm Kim Vanel. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, is this the end of China's experiment with capitalism? President Xi Jinping launches sweeping socialist reforms to address inequality in the world's second biggest economy. And the party is over for the Chinese conglomerate that rode the property boom. Hundreds of billions of dollars in debt, the implosion of Evergrande could take down the banking sector. As traditional analog watchmakers fend off the fashion industry and tech giants that are eating into their business, we find out why sales of second-hand watches are taking off. President Xi Jinping isn't afraid of letting everyone know who is the ultimate power in China. Since his elevation in 2012, he launched an anti-corruption purge of what he called tigers and flies, or high-ranking national and local officials. Then came the internment of millions of Uyghurs in so-called re-education camps in Xinjiang. He followed that up by crushing the hopes of democracy protesters in Hong Kong. Xi's latest target is a huge segment of the economy that has powered growth in recent years. Billionaires, celebrities, property, gaming and tech companies. Xi's reasoning, the side effect of growth has been ever-increasing inequality. It's time, he says, for common prosperity. Take a look at this chart. This is China's Gini coefficient. Basically, it's a measure of inequality. The closer you are to one, the more unequal society is. In 2019, it stood at around 0.47. Remember, anything above 0.40 is considered destabilizing. And that is the one thing that the Communist Party fears the most: social unrest. Xi is concerned that the young and rural migrants to cities are being priced out of the property market, and education isn't enough to improve the lot of the poorest. Take a look now at this from the World Economic Forum. This is their social mobility tracker. We've selected a handful of countries out of 82. You can see China lags behind Russia, the United States, and most of Europe. And here's another play on the same theme. This study by the OECD shows how many generations it would take to climb out of the bottom 10% into mean income status. For China, you can see it's 7 generations compared to 5 for the United States and just 2 at the top there for Denmark. And with China creating 2 new billionaires every week, the top 1% are increasing their share of the nation's wealth. As you can see from this graph compiled by Bloomberg, in 1989, the top 1% and bottom 50% owned roughly, you can see there, an equal share of the wealth. But move along here, and by 2015, the share held by the bottom 50% shrunk and the top 1% increased their share to a third. And there is so much more to talk about, but let's start with Xi's crackdown. As told by our correspondent Katrina Yu, she begins this report with Beijing's ban on tutoring, which is hoped to ease the financial burden on parents.
Wall Street English once sold private tutoring sessions to Chinese students keen to improve through extra study. Now, it's one of more than 1,000 companies forced to close their doors following sweeping new education regulations. Tutoring companies can no longer teach compulsory school subjects, teach during school hours, nor earn a profit. Thousands of foreign tutors like Catherine Peterson have suddenly found themselves redundant. The American has taught English and critical thinking skills in China for 5 years.
This is going to impact the industry a lot, and especially now with COVID, it's so hard for foreigners to come into the country too. I think it might mean a huge downsizing of the industry.
Many parents invested in tutors to help their children boost their results in hyper-competitive exams known as Gaokao that they need to pass to get into universities. But many say China's tutoring industry that was once worth an estimated $140 billion is now decimated. Chen Yusha lost her job as an administrator in one of China's biggest tutoring companies and is now struggling to find work.
Because of the huge demand, this industry was booming, but it put a lot of pressure on parents because extra tutoring is not cheap.
The Chinese government hopes its crackdown on private tutoring will reduce the cost of raising a child and ease pressure on families. China's birth rate is slowing, and authorities are desperately trying to encourage couples to have more children. But analysts say this isn't the only goal. Authorities also want to encourage investment in more innovative areas of China's IT industries to create greater competition with high-tech companies in the West.
Amazon is investing heavily in space technology. Elon Musk is conquering Mars. But those IT giants in China, they're making money off parents' anxieties.
But some worry that the government ban may just lead to a black market in private tutoring.
Just because the government has banned or is trying to cut back on a certain kind of education, I don't think that will stop parents from trying to pursue it.
The government says it's offering support to thousands of people affected by the measures, but that may not be enough to help all of those reeling from the shock of seeing their teaching career in China suddenly at an end. Millions of young fans loyal to famous actors and singers are a lucrative force in China's entertainment industry. Now, celebrity fan clubs have become the latest target of government regulators. Authorities have banned activities which encourage fans to spend money on their favorite stars. Online celebrity rankings and discussions about their salaries are also prohibited. State media newspaper, The Global Times, says fan clubs could be used to manipulate minds and split Chinese society. Mega-rich entertainers have been criticized and punished for tax evasion and other undesirable behaviors. The moves are part of Beijing's efforts to promote Chinese socialist values among young people and crack down on so-called negative influences in entertainment culture. It follows the announcement of new rules limiting how much time young people can spend playing online video games. Minors can now log on for 3 hours a week maximum and only on weekends. Beijing says the curbs are necessary to combat gaming and internet addiction, but critics say it'll do the opposite.
I don't think the new regulation makes any sense. It aims to help teenagers, but the less access you get, the more curious you will be.
On the surface, these changes seem like rules designed to stop unhealthy or obsessive behaviors among young people. But for the Chinese Communist Party, it's much more. It sees the entertainment industry as an ideological battleground that needs to be kept in check. Regulators have also banned the portrayal of effeminate men, and online LGBTQI communities have been censored. Activist Ah Ming says the government is actively trying to mold the identity of young Chinese.
The government wants a traditional image for its people, not a diverse one. I think this really limits the imagination and creativity of the young people. It shows the society is becoming less accepting to those who are different.
Ah Ming and others like him are worried there are more changes ahead, and the freedoms of Chinese youth will increasingly be replaced by the agenda of the communist government.
Let's take a deep dive into Xi's common prosperity with Iris Pang. Iris is the chief economist for Greater China with ING Bank. She joins me now from Hong Kong via Skype. Thank you for your time. So Xi Jinping has called for common prosperity. How big of a problem is inequality?
So if we talk about inequality, we usually use the Gini index. Gini index in China back into 2000 was 0.412. Any readings above 0.4 indicates an inequality issue. But after that, after 2000, there have been no updates on the Gini index in China. So we don't know the actual situation. But as I have seen, rural side has increasingly being more wealthy than previously. So I think the inequality issue is that there are many people or corporates that are very rich. And although the rural side has become more wealthy, the inequality, the gap, has widened.
Common prosperity, though, isn't a new theme, is it? Why is it that we're hearing more and more about it now?
Common prosperity isn't new at all. For example, we know that in some countries, their tax rate is very high That is because they want to narrow the wealth gap and redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor. So now China is experiencing there are more rich people, super rich people, as you said. So there, I expect there will be a more progressive tax rate system in China for corporates as well as for individuals.
But if we think about why President Xi Jinping is pushing this common prosperity theme, I mean, is there a political element to it too? Does he want perhaps a third term?
I think he doesn't have to do anything for his third term. He has changed the system that he can roll over continuously. So I think it is not about domestic politics. It's more about the living quality of people, especially those in the base of the pyramid. They the government wants them to live in a style that is closer to the rich.
China is the second biggest economy, yet I believe 600 million people, half the population, live on about $150 a month. So do you think these efforts to tackle that will have the sort of impact that's needed?
It depends on how the government do it. So there are many reports that the government will do it through property tax. I don't fully agree. Property tax is just one tool to do this. As I've said, I expect a more progressive tax system on corporate tax as well as individual tax. The government can introduce wealth tax, but this is not really ideal because this will actually disincentivize the people to climb the wealth ladder. So I believe progressive tax is enough to balance the rich and the poor more effectively.
Is this the end, do you think, of the capitalist experiment or an acknowledgement perhaps that we can't leave everything to the market?
I think it is the second. In many places there are a kind of government controls, government policies. For example, taxation is one of them in economic theory. If it is a purely market economy, we may not have taxation. I would say that it is the second. But of course, how to do it is that in China, it will be quite a socialist method. So we will hear a lot of slogan or jargon like common prosperity in China, which we may not hear it in other economies, even they share the same idea.
With a huge population and an almost endless pool of labour, was this perhaps inevitable?
Wealth gap is inevitable in all economies, I think. But how wide is the wealth gap? If we can narrow it a little bit, it will be better for the base in the pyramid, and those are the struggling to climb the wealth ladder. I think it is also important for the children in the poor family that can get access to high quality education and chances in the society so that they can move up the ladder.
Xi Jinping has overhauled the $100 billion tutoring industry, taken on tech giants, gaming, even hit out at celebrities. Has there been any meaningful study as to what impact that may have on the economy?
First of all, the tuition centres, it already creates a pool of jobless young people. And those young people are actually middle-income class in China. Just in Beijing City alone, there are more than 90,000 young people being jobless because of the shutdowns of tuition centres. So you can actually simply multiply it by four so that you can get the four biggest cities' jobless people from the tuition policy. And on the online game policies, I think it is not about jobless. It is about how to switch to other business plans within the company, so they still need the people. So it is not that damaging. But it gives room for foreign brands to take into this game market, because some game consoles that are famous in the world are made by Japan, and they will easily get the market share because those don't need to be online at all. And the policy only pinpoints on online games.
I just want to ask you quickly before we run out of time. We have this huge, if we look to the property sector, we have this huge property company, Evergrande, which is, I believe, $300 billion in debt. Advisors are being called in to look at the structuring of the company, assess its liquidity. Will that be allowed to go under? Would that company be allowed to go under? And what kind of impact would that have?
I think survival is still the main theme, because the Chinese government doesn't want to create extreme condition in the market and extreme conditions in the financial sector, because they lend to these real estate companies also. So I believe that there will be solutions that avoid extreme conditions.
All right, Chief Economist for Greater China with ING Bank, Iris Pang, thank you very much for your time. At the centre of the inequality problem was China's policy for rapid urbanisation, which meant building millions of homes. It contributed to breakneck economic growth and created sprawling property giants. As we just mentioned, Evergrande is now on the brink of collapse after taking on debts of $300 billion. Once again, here's Katrina Yu.
Evergrande is one of the biggest real estate conglomerates in China. It employs 200,000 people nationwide and even owns a Chinese football team. But the Hong Kong-listed giant has become one of the most indebted companies in the world, with more than $300 billion worth of liabilities. And it's struggling to pay it back, sparking fears of a default that could send tremors through China's economy.
It's not just in the property business, though. It also has a new energy branch, a logistics branch. It has business in almost every major city and many counties in China.
Evergrande has suspended interest payments to some lenders and delayed payments to others. This week, ratings agencies Fitch and Moody's downgraded its credit status. Company shares have plummeted by 75% since the beginning of the year.
China can be said to have two property markets. In major cities like Beijing, prices are rising. Here in the CBD, the average two-bedroom apartment costs more than $1.3 million. But in smaller Chinese cities, there's an oversupply of housing and prices are slumping. Investing too much in those areas has led to many of Evergrande's debt problems.
Tighter regulations in China's financial market have also made it difficult for the firm to raise cash. Employees have protested outside Evergrande offices, saying their salaries haven't been paid. Chinese authorities met with company management last month, demanding they resolve its debt. But analysts say the government is unlikely to let Evergrande go bankrupt.
They do not want to bail out all those bad behaviors, but still, it will be too strong a signal if it actually failed. So I think there will be some effort to bail out at least a portion of Evergrande's business. And maybe strategic investors will be encouraged from the private sector trying to take over some of the business.
Evergrande is renegotiating payment deadlines with banks and other creditors. More than 1.5 million home buyers waiting for their properties to be completed by the firm are holding their breath.
The multi-billion dollar traditional premium to luxury watch market is expected to see little in the way of growth over the coming years. The industry is under attack from smartwatch makers and fashion houses that are rolling out their own brands. Apple has come to dominate the smartwatch market. With the launch of its new Apple Watch 7, which boasts a bigger screen, it hopes to see off competition from Samsung and Google's Fitbit. The smartwatch market is expected to be worth $59 billion in 2021, whereas the traditional market was valued at $49 billion in 2019 and is expected to be worth up to $59 billion in 2025. While the traditional market is under threat, the pre-owned or second-hand market is growing. It was worth $18 billion in 2019 and is expected to be worth $32 billion by the middle of this decade. The pandemic has sent sales online, and one of the companies taking advantage is a collected man. And I'm delighted to say that the founder and CEO, Silas Walton, is with me now from London. Thank you for joining us. So is the traditional watchmaker business under threat from smartphone makers and also from fashion houses?
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me. You know, I think it's a very valid question. I think when the Apple Watch joined the fray 5 years ago, I think much of the traditional watch industry was fearful about the consequences. I think that what's happened is there's been a push for innovation, inevitably, as that's traditionally the response in the face of an existential threat to any market. But I think what's particularly interesting is that there's been a boom in the more traditional, let's say, end of the market, artisanal watchmaking, everything that's complicated or a little bit independent or high-end.
Yeah, and to that end, there's been growing interest in the pre-owned market, which, of course, you're capitalizing on. Why do you think that is?
Look, I think consumers are increasingly discerning, value-conscious. They have an interest in sustainability in many cases. And equally, they're looking for something a little bit more interesting. And if you think about it, today you can choose from a limited range of watches available on the market new according to what the brand has in their portfolio. But if you look at pre-owned, you can pretty much have your pick from the last 50 years of watchmaking, more or less.
Talk us through what kind of people are interested in pre-owned watches. What's the demographic that you're seeing coming through?
I mean, it's a complete range and spectrum. Today, it's young people, it's people, you know, of all ages, all over the world, digital natives, people who are perhaps a little bit more averse or risk averse to online, all areas of the world. It's an absolutely booming market, and it's really not specific to any particular demographic, I would say.
Quite interesting, though, that digital natives, that younger people are interested in these pre-owned traditional analog watches. I mean, you would think that they would be more looking at the smartwatch sort of end of things.
Yeah, I think in many cases, smartwatches open the door at the same time as information became more available and educational information became more available online to a whole new generation. So once you had remotivated people of a certain age to put a watch on their wrist that perhaps hadn't thought about it before or weren't really interested, suddenly they were thinking, well, actually, I'm used to having this. As I turn my wrist to the left, so I can you know, check the time on my wrist. It's convenient to me. Maybe there's something else. And often I think that leads to subsequent discovery of mechanical watchmaking.
Tell us, how did you come to start your business? What was your journey?
I mean, so I started A Collected Man 7 years ago. And when we started, pre-owned was really not a wild west, but it was a hyper-traditional market. It was not at all really online or social media friendly. You know, the principal actors, protagonists were high street retailers and auction houses. And for me, it just felt like an inevitability that the direction of travel would be more digital. And so we focused on that. And so we've been a digital first, education centered, social media, you know, highly present business from day one. And today that's, you know, where the market wants us to be.
Of course. I mean, as you say, you were digital from day one, but how did the pandemic change your business, if at all?
The pandemic obviously had appalling consequences for so many people across the world, so many businesses. I think our business was fortunate in the sense that we were already poised to benefit from some of the changes that the global pandemic catalyzed. So people just became more and more comfortable spending higher amounts of money online, reaching out online without seeing in person, reading about things online. You know, we have a journal where we publish articles 2-3 times a week that are, you know, written by professional journalists and highly researched. And I think as a result, you know, all those things came together, as well as a growing acceptance of of the pre-owned concept. And it really favored our business model.
Just finally, how have you managed to build up your clientele? I mean, are these people who want to publicize who they are?
So it's a very, you know, some clients are incredibly discreet, incredibly confidentiality sensitive, captains of industry, you know, people in the film industry, in the music industry, etc. Other people are, you know, very, very comfortable with social media, either because they grew up with it or because they were early adopters. You know, everyone has to be careful about how they present themselves and how they present the things they own. But most consumers, I would say today, are increasingly sophisticated. And you know, they know what they're doing. They know how to handle it.
All right. Thank you very much for your time, Silas Walton, there, CEO of A Collected Man.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at Kim Vanel, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. There's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. And that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Kim Vidal from the whole team here in Doha. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.